Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. We'll be getting into the week's security news with Adam Boileau of CyberCX in just a moment, and then we'll be hearing from this week's sponsor. And this week's sponsor interview is a real treat. HD Moore will be joining us to talk about his latest venture, Rumble. Now, the boring way to describe it is that it's an asset discovery tool that you use to identify internal assets, but it's HD Moore, so this tool is full of mad genius flair. Look, even if you're a pen tester, you should absolutely listen to this one, because HD, you know, he used to use Rumble on engagements all the time when he was working as a pen tester. It is a truly brilliant, brilliant tool, and he'll be joining us, as I say, a little bit later on in the show to talk you all through it. That is coming up later, but first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with Adam Boileau. And Adam, we're going to start off with a bombshell report from Krebs on Security, dealing with a previously reported breach at Ubiquity. This is a funny story. He's got access to someone he says is a whistleblower from Ubiquity. At the time of this breach, Ubiquity said that it was a breach at a third-party cloud provider. This whistleblower says that they were being shifty there because the third-party provider they were talking about was Amazon. And what they were actually referring to was their entire AWS environment getting rinsed, which is a little bit different to a breach at a third party as we usually understand it. What else has this report thrown up?
So the story appears to be that their AWS environment gets compromised, you know, access to the virtual machines running in the AWS, access to the databases, access to the authentication creds. It sounds like the attacker initially got access to a password safe with a bunch of creds for their AWS and then escalated that into control of that. But they're saying that that includes, obviously, you know, data about the customers, password hashes, but also all of the necessary crypto material for, like, forging SSO tokens for onwards auth to other things. Which, given that, you know, Ubiquity's main thrust these days is, you know, network gear, on-premise, you know, IoT gear that's managed through their cloud interface, that's kind of concerning. If this means that you can get onwards access to gear in people's homes or businesses, I mean, you know, they make a lot of cameras and wireless gear and stuff that's, you know, deployed in a lot of places. So, yeah, that's a little bit different than, hey, a third party got owned, maybe we lost a little customer data. Doesn't seem anything bad happened, which was kind of how they tried to spin it back in January.
Yeah, and it's interesting, right, because this whistleblower says, yeah, they said there was no evidence that, you know, customer stuff was affected. It is like, he's like, but that's because they don't really do much logging, you know? So, of course, there's no evidence. So, looking pretty bad for Ubiquity. Their share price has taken a bit of a hit. I see some people passing around a Yahoo Finance press release link from some company called Block and Leviton LLP. I believe they're law firm, and they're you know, investigating Ubiquity for possible securities laws violations. But if you put Block and Leviton and investigated into Google and do a search, like, they've investigated everyone apparently, so I don't know that this is as as big a deal as people think it is. But I've also linked through in this week's show notes to the report Catalin Kimpanu wrote about this incident for January 11. And it's really interesting comparing the Krebs write-up next to the ZDNet write-up from back when Ubiquity were playing it down, because they're describing two different things.
Yeah, and so if you were a customer and you had got that comms back in January, the set of things that you would have to worry about and you should do is clearly very different than the picture we get presented from this write-up with a, you know, with an internal whistleblower. So, yeah, I mean, I imagine if you're a Ubiquity customer, then it's kind of hard to know what to do, right? I mean, if it's a case that attackers have the necessary material to break into your network already, and you have to rely on Ubiquity to manage your stuff, like, you're kind of a little bit screwed there in terms of what you're supposed to do. And, you know, back in January, Ubiquity, you know, was like, I guess you could reset your passwords and turn on your 2FA, I suppose, but you don't really have to, which was, yeah, not a particularly compelling story to tell now that we see the you know, the shape of it.
Well, and Ubiquity gear is popular with, like, our demographic, right? This show's demographic. Yes. It's considered the cool gear, but maybe this is going to knock a bit of the shine off it.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly was that kind of niche of prosumer, right? People who are actual nerds, want all the cool toys, but don't want to pay Cisco prices. And certainly, you know, even 5 years ago, if you were comparing this to, you know, other network equipment, like, it had all the features, the price was reasonable, security was a little bit meh, but I mean, hey, so was, you know, the pricey gear, and it, you know, was quite attractive for, you know, nerds building kind of enterprise style stuff in their houses and a lot of businesses. So, you know, they've been pushing everything to be much more cloud managey, and I think that scared a lot of people in our demographic away for good reason, it turns out. But yeah, there's just a lot of it around, and I think there's going to be a lot of pretty salty nerds on InfoSec Twitter.
Yeah, and let's see if this is a developing story or if it just all goes quiet again. I mean, I think that's a coin toss at this stage. I think it depends what else gets turned up, if there's an investigation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Moving on, we're going to just whiz through a few of the ransomware incidents of this week, but I knew you were going to love this one, Adam, the first ransomware incident we've got in the news today.
So this report is about an insurer in the US called CNA, which apparently is one of the top insurers for, you know, kind of breach insurance. There was, and yeah, they've had themselves be ransomware. That's pretty bad. A bunch of data taken. You know, obviously insurance firms, you know, collect a bunch of sensitive data about their customers, you know, and, you know, provide a very fertile ground for regular data theft. But there was that report we talked about a while ago where a ransomware operator gave an interview and they said, oh yeah, the best approach we've got is you own the cyber insurer, steal all the information, then you kind of work through the customers one by one. And when you're done, then you can go and ransomware the insurer as well. And you know, what they're covered for, you know, what the conditions are, you know, how much they're willing to pay, what their excess is, all that kind of thing. You've got all their data, so you can kind of, you know, negotiate from a very strong position. And then, of course, you know, when we talked about that piece, I'm like, I wonder when we're going to see the insurer get popped. And here we are.
Yes, here we are. And it'll be interesting, I think, for that insurer to actually experience one of these incidents themselves, and maybe they're going to have to go talk to the actuaries, basically.
Yes, I mean, oh dear. I mean, we shouldn't make fun of victims of crime, but, you know.
Well, I mean, I think we've been saying for 10 years that trying to do normal risk modeling on this stuff from a sort of insurance perspective, it doesn't quite work, right? Like, it just doesn't quite work. And it's, you know, I've flip-flopped on that a little bit, but I think I've wound up back where we started, which is, yeah, it doesn't work. And this is kind of proof, I think, a little bit.
I mean, I've certainly been in favor of, you know, hey, insurance, they understand how to manage risk properly. They will get this right and save us. No, they haven't.
No, they haven't. It hasn't worked out. We tried being optimistic for a little while. It didn't work out.
We did.
Basically. We really did. One of a giant education trust, a school trust in the United Kingdom, in London, the Harris Federation, they've been ransomwared as well. That's causing them some drama. It looks like it hasn't affected the delivery of school services, though, for now. We've also seen that Honeywell has returned to service after some sort of intrusion. They don't say whether that's ransomware, but odds on, you know, 9 times out of 10, that's what it tends to be. Now, look, we're going to turn our attention to some developments in Australia. It's been a big week for serious cyber news in Australia, and probably the biggest ticket item is a very mysterious ransomware attack against Nine Entertainment. Now, most of our audience is based, the vast majority of our audience is based outside of Australia. So I'll just explain that Nine Entertainment is, you know, a large media organization that has interests in television and newspapers. So the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age, The Australian Financial Review, they are all now part of Nine Entertainment, the Channel 9 network, you know, massive company. A lot of their staff are now working from home. Broadcasts have been disrupted. It's been a very significant attack. The best reporting that I've been able to turn up is, funnily enough, by a guy who works for the Financial Review, Paul Smith. He was my editor when I was a freelancer back in the day. He's a very, very good reporter. And he was the first to reveal that it was the Medusa ransomware, although it looks like Nine didn't receive a note. Now, this is didn't receive a ransom note. Indeed, there was a memo being sent to staff saying, hey, can you find this HTML file, which is like, you know, ransom note.html or whatever that's associated with Medusa. But that's left everyone scratching their heads about what the possible motivation behind this is. And it's led to a whole bunch of groundless speculation that this might be some sort of state-backed attack. But the truth is, we just don't know what's happening here.
Yeah, the reporting has been pretty confused. And that report from Paul Smith over at the AFR did seem the most sensible, you know, attributing it to ransomware in particular. You know, the Medusa one kind of makes sense. You know, the other reporting we've seen from other mastheads, you know, some Nine and some wider afield, you know, have been a bit more confused. And there's been a lot of, oh my God, we wrote a piece about Vladimir Putin. You know, we're working on some stuff about China. Obviously, there's, you know, lots of things that are relevant to Australian politics and international relations that, you know, that these mastheads do cover. But yeah, there's, you know, the reporting that it was, you know, oh my God, maybe it was the Russians taking us out a la Sony Pictures or something like that. It was, you know, all very exciting. But, you know, bog standard ransomware does seem a more reasonable explanation. And, you know, the fact they haven't got a ransom note, honestly, you know, ransomware crews probably got a lot of irons on the fire at the moment. And hey, maybe they just screwed up. Like, that seems to be a more likely, perhaps.
We have seen, although we have seen destructive attacks launched by governments using COTS ransomware, right? So we just don't know. And it's funny because when I've been thinking through this, it kept taking me back to that scene in Reservoir Dogs, the Quentin Tarantino movie about a botched diamond heist from the early 90s where all of the robbers, well, some of the robbers get back to their safe house and there's some guys missing. And they ask Mr. Blonde about the location of one of the criminals. And here's what he said.
Either he's alive or he's dead. Or the cops got him, or they don't.
And that's pretty much where we are with this one, right? Like, we don't don't really know what's happened. But what we do know is, you know, you attack a media company and journalists tend to think they're the center of the universe, right? So they all think it's Vladimir Putin or China or whatever. I mean, it's possible. But yeah, again, we just don't know. And the speculation is really unhelpful.
I mean, I just think, like, if you were a government agent and you were going to use off-the-shelf ransomware to disrupt operations, why not just ask for the ransom? Like, you know, you can stick it in the beer fund or, you know, you can send it off to the actual ransomware operator. Like, if you were trying to muddy the waters as to where it came from, then, you know, why would it just, it's, I know, it seems funny to me. And you're right. We just don't know. And it sounds like, you know, they're working pretty hard at nine to get it contained and to be in a position to recover. And they are still at least broadcasting some things. So clearly there's a, you know, a lot of very busy people over there dealing with the fallout of this. And that can't be a fun time.
It's my understanding that it's still ongoing, right? But they've called in ASD, the AFP are there. And yeah, I do know who the IR provider they're using is, and they're pretty good. So we'll just have to see how it plays out. I think, you know, the two journalists who I think have been really doing a solid job covering this is, yeah, as I mentioned, Paul Smith at the Australian Financial Review and Ry Crozier over at itnews.com.au. So kudos to both of you for actually doing some hyperbole-free reporting. That's been very helpful, guys. Moving on, and look, staying with Australia, it looks like there's been some sort of incident that has affected email and calendar systems at Australian Parliament House. It's my understanding that this might have something to do with their mobile iron deployment.
But yeah, we don't know beyond kind of interruption to email and calendaring exactly what's going on. You know, we've seen attacks on parliamentary networks all around the world, so it's probably not a surprise to see it in Canberra.
I did see one report that said it was a really, like, crappy attempt, but the line that jumped out of that report, which is why I haven't included it, which is like, oh, but the system detected it and shut itself down, which is exactly what it's supposed to do, and I'm like, just thinking, I don't believe you at all on that one.
Exactly, yeah.
So, look, again, that's, you know, that's another instance where we don't really know what's happened, but a whole bunch of people at Australian Parliament House suddenly lost access to their mobile, you know, email and calendar events and stuff like that. So initially people were thinking it might have been some sort of exchange related thing, but we should know more in the future. Now, this last Australia related story that I wanted to talk about is the one that I found the most interesting. Some threat actor out there has been socially engineering Australian politicians via WhatsApp to set up Telegram accounts, right? So they contact them via WhatsApp and say, download and install Telegram, but then they socially engineer them into passing over the 2FA code. And what that means is these attackers are able to set up Telegram accounts from that politician's number. Now, Telegram isn't that popular in Australia and among Australian politicians. So essentially what they're able to do is to get valid Telegram accounts to trusted phone numbers, right? So we know of at least two frontbench ministers where this has been the case. Now then, it's what happens next that's really interesting, is they've been using that Telegram access to message other Australian politicians who do have Telegram installed and ask them, do we know anyone in Hong Kong? Right? So asking them for contacts in Hong Kong, that information is then being passed back to the attackers. And then what happens after that is they start trying to do fraud stuff, right? Like, oh, by the way, can you send money to this bank account? So what this looks like to me is some sort of state adjacent crew who have been tasked with doing some collection and then told, well, you know, and if you can monetize that access afterwards, go for your life. That's what it feels like to me.
I mean, that's horrible and cynical, and unfortunately, yeah, that kind of matches what you're describing, because it's been a pretty messy story when we've seen it reported, because it's a bit unclear about how all the parts worked. But yeah, like using that to ferret out people in Hong Kong to be targeted by presumably the Chinese government, that's really horrible.
Who do Australian politicians regard as being trusted contacts in Hong Kong? That is information that is valuable to a particular country.
Yes, it is. And that's pretty gross. But I suppose it's what we live in now, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's a clever campaign, though, you've got to admit.
Yeah, it is. It's smoothly done. And then whether or not the pivot to fraud works out or not, I guess we'll see if there's reports that, money's been moved around.
Yeah, we'll see. And meanwhile, a bunch of German politicians are getting fished by the looks of things by people who have interests that seem to overlap with Russian, the Russian Federation's interests, right?
Yeah, this was reporting on a number of attempted phishing campaigns to get creds for mail systems related to German politicians. The tradecraft did suggest that it was a group that had been targeting other Eastern European or other European countries, as you say, aligned with Russian interests. No surprise there. There's no reports that any were actually successful, but it's good that the Germans are keeping an eye on things.
Now to a story that broke just after we recorded last week's show. The Biden administration is planning to issue an executive order that would require software vendors to disclose to their customers, like federal government customers, when they've been breached, right? And to be more transparent about those things. And it's interesting that this has come up, about a week ago, and then the first story we spoke about today was this Ubiquiti thing. I mean, it's good timing, in a sense, to sort of demonstrate the value of this kind of idea.
I mean, if anything, it seems ridiculous that you wouldn't have to tell your federal government customers if you got yourself owned. But hey, that's America's a bit funny like that. But yeah, there's a bunch of interesting aspects there. And obviously, disclosing when you've had a security incident is super important. There's also some discussion of things like software bills of material to try and, help the government understand what software components they have to care about, which, is pretty important when we look at how supply chains have been working lately.
Well, the software analysis companies are going to love that part of it.
There's certainly going to be a lot of work here to kind of meet the requirements that they're talking about. And I think, for companies that sell a lot of different products, that will be a lot of effort. And I'm sure there will be a few niche providers that do make good money out of kind of supporting this work. But it's interesting that we're seeing it in the form of an executive order, because kind of more sensible kind of legislation has just been bogged down for so long, trying to, arrive at sensible cyber outcomes from legislation. I guess it's hard. So yeah, in this form factor, maybe it's easier for them to work through.
Well, yeah, I mean, passing laws in the United States is very hard, and it tends to be, actually passing acts of legislation tends to be reserved for the big stuff, right? So, it makes sense that this is an EO. But what I find this interesting is it essentially amounts to a new type of compliance regime. And, normally you look at compliance regimes generally and they tend to give you some incremental gains. But this actually seems like it seems well designed. Let's put it that way. That's what I think anyway.
Yeah, and certainly even if it's a case of, it's an executive order that applies to companies doing business with the federal government,
that's a lot of companies,
the benefits of that, it is, right? And hopefully the benefits of that roll down into the rest of the private sector and other uses of it. Because if you've done that compliance work once, you may as well kind of lean on it dealing with everybody else. So hopefully we kind of see that trickle down because of just the sheer size of US government as a customer.
Yeah. Now, a couple of stories here which are interesting little bookends, right? So Facebook has disrupted a Chinese campaign targeting Uyghur Muslims.
Yes, they've obviously been unwrapping a number of campaigns that use their platform, and also some of these that appear to tie into research we've seen come out of Project Zero, campaigns using iOS bugs and Android bugs and things, and attributed these through to some specific Chinese companies, that are carrying out these attacks on behalf of their government. So that's kind of ties together a bunch of the reports that we've seen, over the last year or two to these particular actors. And yeah, interesting to see the private sector doing this.
It is. Now we're going to talk about another similar story. I mean, my reaction when I read that story is like, that's fantastic. Okay. That is unquestionably fantastic that Facebook was able to disrupt that campaign. And then we move on to this story, which is, I think by far the most interesting report over the last week. It comes to us via Patrick Howell O'Neill at MIT Technology Review. And it's sort of confirming something that we hinted at last week. when we were talking about that recent Project Zero work that uncovered something like 11 ODAs being used in the wild, you know, really sophisticated campaign, lots of depth in the types of bugs that they had access to. Like one got patched and they just swapped another one in. And, you know, we said, oh, what sort of agency, you know, like sort of hinting that it looked, it smelled kind of like a Western campaign. Now, Patrick Howell O'Neill at MIT Technology Review has written up a story that says, yes, it was in fact, these bugs were being used as part of a counterterrorism campaign being run by a Western government, but no idea really who that Western, which Western government they're talking about.
Yeah, and this has kind of kicked off a bunch of, you know, introspection both inside and outside Google, you know, about whether or not that's the, you know, what's the right thing to do. Like, should an organization, private sector company like Google, you know, just protect the interests of its users, you know, ferret out software bugs regardless of where they are, get them disclosed and patched, which is kind of the Project Zero, you know, mandate, or do they need to be more mindful of the bigger picture? And we've seen, you know, companies that are, you know, have bugs or things which are involved in kind of law enforcement investigations, cooperating with law enforcement because they recognize that's in the interests of, you know, of the societies they operate in. But when you're dealing with, you know, nation states doing spooky stuff, you know, if you have the information available to you to attribute and other parts of Google, the tag team, you know, part of their business is doing attribution and understanding who the actors are, then that calculus certainly becomes a lot more complicated. And maybe it's not even fair to ask a private sector organization to make that calculus. But yeah, there's a lot of things to think about.
They have to. They find all of that stuff being exploited in the wild. They have to make a call whether they burn it or not. And I mean, the one thing that I kept coming back to on this is I'm glad I'm not the one making these decisions.
Yeah, like, I mean, this is a pretty tough call to have to make. And, you know, also, you know, often you are operating with partial information, right? I mean, these campaigns and operators are very good. And, you know, sometimes maybe you do have enough concrete information to say, yes, absolutely, this is, you know, this country or that country, and we can kind of see how it's being used. But often you're operating with, you know, a subset of the data, and you have to just kind of make a gut feel call, which, yeah, you're right. I'm glad it's not me either.
I mean, it's a watering hole. I mean, the story rules out that it's the US. They say it's a US ally. It was a watering hole style attack. I'm not sure that it's a Five Eyes country. I mean, if I had to guess, it's going to be someone like France, Israel, something like that. But, you know, that's burning a lot of capability. But on the other hand, right, and this is the side that Project Zero wound up on, which is like it's their job to squash bugs. There's a whole bunch of dangerous ODA out there. If they've got it, maybe someone else could get it. It could leak. And onwards we go. And then those same bugs could be, you know, then weaponized by a country like China to target Uyghur Muslims, for example, which we agreed in the previous discussion. You know, that's a thing that we're happy to see shut down. So it's, you know, trying to balance all the equities here is just, it's so hard. And again, I'm glad it's not my decision.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly very difficult when you have a global platform, you know, like Android or iOS or Windows, you know, where you realize that, you know, there's a pool of people looking for the bugs for Western governments, selling Western governments so they can use them. And there's also people looking for those same bugs, you know, for other countries. And, you know, everybody's good at finding bugs, and it's all the same software. The chance of parallel discovery and parallel use, you know, we've seen examples of it, right? It's a thing you do have to take into account. And, you know, and certainly when we see the, you know, suggestions that, you know, we would splinter off the tech ecosystem, you know, anything that's running Red Star Linux, clearly fair game. You don't have to worry about that. You know, that kind of balkanization does help with targeting and with vulnerabilities equities. But yeah, right now this is a real tough position to be in. And I'm, you know, I send hug ops to the Google crew that have to make those calls because dang, yeah.
Well, I mean, I do know people who used to trawl jihadi forums looking for Word documents so they could pull the ODA out of them, right? Like that's a thing. So there is an argument to suggest that, like, you know, if you're a Chinese operator, you're probably going to be all over the jihadi forums waiting for a Western government to be dropping mad ODA, right? Because that's a way to get it.
Yeah, I mean, it is such a complicated kind of twisty turny maze of an industry and a scene and a world to try and operate in and make sensible decisions. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, do we expect Google to be beholden to the US government and to the Western alliance? Probably, yeah. Like, we kind of expect them to operate in our best interests.
Yeah, but do we expect them to just allow rampant ODA exploitation and watering hole attacks that are kind of visible to other countries as well? Like, and that's what I mean. It's
yeah, like if we you expect that, why not just let them back to Android and Chrome? You know, it'll get the job done cheaper.
Well, look, I think there was another thing that I thought of with this too, which is when Kaspersky blew up a counterterrorism op a few years ago, I think that was like 2018. I think that was kind of, to a degree, that was a worse situation because they rolled out detections for Western malware that was being dropped exclusively on, you know, suspected terrorist devices, right? So that would be alerting them to the presence of that type of malware. Whereas this one, I mean, one thing is you patch all these bugs, the people who are being targeted won't know, right? They will not know that this has happened to them just because the bugs were patched, right? And maybe they've got persistence on a number of people, but it just means they won't scoop up anyone new using those same bugs. And they probably will think twice about using their fresh beautiful bugs on the same watering hole as well, right? I don't know. So much to think about. So much.
Yeah. It is super, super complicated and just not clear what the right thing to do is. So
Yeah. And meanwhile, a whole bunch of patches have gone out for those bugs. Apple released a whole bunch of iOS patches that took care of those bugs that were discussed in the P0 report. But anyway, let's move on. And Paul Nakasone, the director of the NSA, he did some testimony up on Capitol Hill, said some interesting stuff about the NSA's lack of visibility into US-based infrastructure. Of course, you know, the people behind the SolarWinds, the so-called SolarWinds campaign, this SVR campaign, they were staging a lot of their attacks off US infrastructure because they knew that basically the US government couldn't go snooping around on it. Nakasone says, look, you know, we need to get some visibility here. And by we, I don't mean NSA. Maybe some domestic agency needs to be responsible for being able to look at this sort of stuff domestically. But he is pointing out quite rightly that it's a blind spot and America's adversaries are using that against them.
Yeah, I mean, certainly jurisdiction shopping when you're picking where you're going to pivot through, you know, is a thing that you consider, right? Making sure you understand what your choice of location exposes you to. And yeah, people are certainly, you know, smart enough to understand the NSA aren't going to be able to snoop on domestic VPSs in the US or, you know, whatever other place they can bounce their infrastructure through. And he makes, you know, it is a solid point, right? They don't have that visibility, also for good reason. And I'm glad to see him kind of, you know, carefully playing it as a, hey, you know, someone needs to look, clearly not us, because otherwise, the whole conversation would have gotten derailed with, you know, all the people that certainly don't want the NSA operating domestically. If it came out and said, hey, we need these powers, then, you know, all hell would break loose probably. So good to see, you know, smart game playing there. But, you know, when you look at something like SolarWinds or the exchange stuff, clearly they've got to have some visibility somehow.
Yeah, that's it. And then, you know, the usual cries of, oh, it's surveillance, you know. And that's the thing. I mean, you know, is detection surveillance? You know, is sort of NIDSY sort of stuff, is that surveillance if a packet happens to pass through a filter that's operated by the government? I don't know. You know, it's just, it's another hard one.
Yeah, I mean, the answer is yes. And also sometimes there are reasons that's useful and it's complicated. And
yes.
Absolutist positions are probably not the answer. And we need something in the middle where all of the nasty, grey, squishy, you know, tough choices are. We've just kind of made such a hash of this in the past. And been so clumsy about how we go about it that everyone's just kind of, you know, everyone's at everyone else's throats about these kinds of issues. And it's very hard to arrive at a sensible, you know, middle ground.
Yeah, no, it is. Now, look, this next story you might not think connects to cybersecurity, but it does. This is a story from Tim DeChant at Ars Technica, which is appearing on wired.com. And it's talking about the availability of vaccines, COVID-19 vaccines on the dark web. Apparently that market is booming, as is the market for falsified vaccination report cards.
Which, you know, we've certainly seen the underworld, you know, adapt to whatever, you know, the situations are around them. And yeah, selling vaccines online, I guess, isn't a surprise as to whether those vaccines are being kept, you know, adequately cold or whatever other constraints.
Or whether or not they're just vials effective with water in them, right?
Whether it's homeopathic vaccine, yes. But it's also interesting that the, you know, like fake vaccine certificates and stuff, apparently they're outselling the vaccines something like 5-1, probably because they're cheaper and easier to, you know, handle the postage and delivery of. But, you know, obviously we're going to see, you know, countries build, you know, slightly more effective systems than just like paper vaccination cards, perhaps digital systems.
Yeah, maybe. Let's see. Where this connects to cybersecurity, in my view, is we've seen a big shift in the last 12 months of governments saying that they're prepared to actually roll disruption operations against criminal syndicates. We've heard governments like, particularly the UK, being very vocal about that, also in Australia, and particularly when it connects to anything COVID-19 related. So the reason I wanted to mention this one is not because it's a dark web thing, but I think they're a pretty good candidate to get the full treatment, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's certainly a pretty cynical use of the, you know, of the privacy of the dark web and doing this kind of thing in a way that doesn't expose you as a criminal to, you know, having hounds released at you. Yeah, yes. It's probably quite difficult. So
let's see. I mean, this is our last show for a few weeks because, of course, I'm going on paternity leave as soon as I finish editing and publishing this week's show. But by the time I come back, you never know, that forum might be gone. Let's just see. Speaking of...
Segway,
yeah. Another carding forum having a bad time. Carding Mafia. No word on who did this, but yeah, owned, you know, whole database dropped, that sort of thing.
Yeah, something like several hundred thousand users worth of data was in the database, about a terabyte, according to the forum postings that are making it available, with, you know, message contents and hashes and users and all the things that you would imagine are in a database for a carding forum, and especially a pretty big and pretty old one like this one, Carding Mafia. That's... What's the count at of number of carding forums that have been, doxed in the last 3 months? It was like 5 or 6 now.
Yeah, something like that. I was going to say 4 or 5, but yeah, it's around that number. But it's a bad time to be operating a carding forum, right? And I would also suggest that it's a bad time to be operating a, illicit COVID-19 vaccine forum.
Yes. Yeah, I think I would stay away from those.
I mean, we don't know. This just could be someone doing this in their spare time for shiggles. We have no idea. But at the same time, like, it's just interesting that we've moved into a situation where it's plausible that it was someone wearing a government ID who did that.
We've certainly attributed a lot of other things on just kind of alignment of intent.
Yeah.
Like whether or not it is a bored white hat or whether it's governments, we don't know. But either way, if someone's taken out carding forms, you know, we're not really complaining.
Now, Joseph Cox has a habit of writing stories that result in actual change. And, you know, it's a real thing among journalists that basically the true measure of success is whether something you write actually results in some sort of change occurring out there in the world, rather than people just saying, oh, that's interesting, and then closing the tab, right? And Joe has a great track record of making things happen. We reported on one of his stories quite recently about how, you know, you could go and pay $16 and basically snag someone's SMSs. It looks like that situation has been resolved.
Yeah, and this is definitely a good thing. The system that was being used, this was kind of a mechanism for people to add text or SMS services to numbers that weren't cell phones. Like that was the original intent. So you could buy a VoIP service or buy a landline and then also still have the ability to receive text messages by providing the number of that. And then there was some kind of message routing arrangement amongst the carriers to go and deliver those. And that was the root kind of service that was being abused. That now appears to have been shut down. And anyone who was using that service for its legitimate reason of, you know, receiving text messages on your landline for whatever reason you'd like to do that, that now no longer works, which seems like the right trade-off.
Yeah, I mean, SMS is still something you shouldn't rely on all that critically, obviously. But the crazy thing about this service is when you brought your own number, you basically just clicked a box to pinky swear that it was actually your number and they didn't do any validation or checking, which is just crazy.
Yeah, and it will be interesting, I think, for people in other countries than the US to go and find out if the equivalent sort of service exists amongst your local carriers. Because, this is obviously a US-specific thing, and there may well be instances of the same thing out there to discover elsewhere.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea for anyone listening who works in telecommunications regulation. Like, maybe you want to go look into that. That's some good thinking there, Mr. Boilo. Moving on and staying with telco, and we've got some research that's landed. Catalan's done a write-up on it. Some research into 5G protocol vulnerabilities. And these seem to apply when you're dealing with a sort of mixed tech network, you know, 5G plus legacy support, and you wind up with some issues there. Nothing too surprising, I guess.
Yeah, this is research looks into the use of network slicing, which is a mechanism for in 5G networks for operators to kind of segment the radio network up such that it can provide, I guess, kind of like quality of service. So you can say how like this portion of the network is going to serve, you know, automotive connected devices, and this bit's for, you know, regular voice and data, and provide some kind of guarantees and ability there, and also to be able to share between operators. So there's a bunch of kind of virtualization functions, the researchers appear to have found some issues that would allow, for example, user tracking and things like that. The prerequisite conditions for this, I'm a little bit unclear about. I mean, 5G is still very new and not super well understood, at least by me anyway. So I'm not sure exactly what the prerequisites are and how real this is, you know, given that 5G deployments are still, you know, pretty new around the world. But yeah, there's good to see that this research is looking into it, given the importance of mobile tech on the security of probably pretty much everything IoT in the future.
Yeah, there's just this one line in the piece that said, despite being a newer and more modern telecommunications protocol, 5G is often exposed to attacks due to the need to support legacy features, so 5G customers could interact with older gen standards. That's where I got the previous gen stuff. But yeah, I'm not super clear on the prerequisites either. And that line is a little bit confusing now that I read it again.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess we'll have to see, you know, what the full set of research looks like there and whether it's practical. And obviously there's plenty of people doing that kind of stuff, so good.
Yep. PHP got its Git server owned.
No.
Someone added some backdoors to the PHP source because, of course, they run their own Git because they're PHP. But they caught it within a couple of hours, which is, you know, nice catch there, guys. And they have now moved the source code over to GitHub, which, you know, probably a little, you know, better late than never. Let's just say that.
Yeah, so I mean, this is certainly, it's a bad story, but also kind of a good news story. You know, open source projects running their own infrastructure for this kind of thing, you know, is largely a historical precedent. Like, the reasons for that are lost to the winds of time, and seeing them move into a platform like GitHub, obviously probably going to provide better prevention for this sort of thing in the future. The story went that someone who had shelled git.php.net had then made a couple of commits signed by a couple of main developers and maintainers that introduced a backdoor that actually, funnily enough, had like a trigger string, which was Zerodium.
Yeah.
The people who, you know, buy Zero Day.
Someone must
be salty about them.
That's the one of two string jokes that we'll get to this week, actually, but that other one's coming up later.
And so, yeah, essentially, if people had used this version of PHP, you could send a secret header, a user agent with two T's, to the web server with the string Zerodium in it, and then some PHP that would then result in it being executed. And that, yeah, they caught this a few hours after it was committed. It's not 100% clear whether it was a like regular review process or just the fact that the sort of people who work on PHP as devs are nerds and care a lot about PHP and spotted it, you know, very quickly and effectively rolled it back. I don't think, according to them, it didn't make it into any, you know, releases or branches or any other kind of things that would have been published in that window. But hey, if you were one of the three people that forked, you know, cloned off a copy of the PHP Git, you know, during that exact window, probably worth checking. But once again, sort of nerd that did that probably is going to know about this and be fine. So no impact other than comedy.
You do wonder, though, how often this sort of stuff slides through, right? So we've got a great example here of where they caught it, but I'm sure there's plenty of stuff where people haven't caught it. And I'm not just talking about PHP here. It's a big old world.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, a big central project like this kind of you would hope would catch it, but there's so many, you know, just little projects that do important things that it's only one developer in his spare time, and yeah, this kind of stuff would slip through.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's why we've seen so much good supply chain attacks lately.
Now, talk me through this Netmask SSRF vulnerability. This is Netmask is an NPM package, which is apparently, you know, very, very popular. It's used in nearly 280,000 projects. Apparently there's some bug in it. It's being written up with, you know, trumpets basically over at the Daily Swig. There's a lot of fanfare, but is this a big deal? Talk us through it.
So this is a bug in Netmask, which is a package for processing IP addresses, you know, kind of validating them, formatting them, handling the many different ways you can express IP addresses. And obviously that's pretty important when you're dealing with preventing server-side request forgery bugs, because, you know, you want to, for example, prevent people from requesting 127.0.1 or other, you know, kind of similar addresses. And the core bug related to parsing like octal encoded digits, you know, in the URLs, and you could result in kind of a canonicalization thing and have an URL that you didn't intend to be validated to get through this whole thing. Anyway, this library is used by a whole bunch of stuff because obviously parsing IP addresses is done everywhere, and the kind of downstream impact of this is dependent on where this package is used in, you know, millions of different places. So anything that's kind of with this sort of supply chain gives bug hunters, you know, bug bounty kids and attackers, you know, a place to go and look. And probably they can look faster than the developers will find out. So that's kind of, I guess, the thing that worries, you know, a place like Daily Swig that's very focused on web app bugs, because attackers, you know, the asset notes of this world are going to go look at this and go, oh yeah, bug time, let's roll, and be able to do it faster than devs.
Yeah, okay, but what does this get you? I mean, I understand that you can fiddle and, you know, cause IP addresses that aren't intended to be validated to be validated, but how much control do you have ultimately over what spits out at the other end?
Well, I mean, that's the interesting part about it, is that it's dependent on how it's used in each of the individual projects.
Yeah, okay.
And what you're looking for here is a way to bypass filters and get server-side request forgery and leverage that into, you know, calling internal APIs, stealing AWS tokens, et cetera, et cetera. We talked last week about how SSRF2 internal functionality is one of the main things that's getting appliances wrecked lately. So, yeah, this kind of thing is, you know, it's a very fertile place to go look and get, you know, impact that's going to vary per application.
That report was by Adam Bannister at the Daily Swig, and he's got another one here talking more about H2C smuggling.
Yeah, we touched on this briefly because it was like the number one web, new web app bug class or new web app thing that Portswigger wrote up in their list of bugs for the year. And yeah, this was related to making connections through a proxy, a front-end proxy that implements some security rules, and then upgrading that connection to HTTP2 such that you can then continue to make onwards requests to the back-end server without going through the front-end's filtering. And Bishop Fox had written up this as a very interesting piece of research. Subsequent researchers have now looked at it and found some examples of where this pattern of bug also applied to a number of other places that the original researchers at Bishop Fox didn't kind of realize was the case and is perhaps more prevalent than we thought. So, you know, definitely good web app research, and I imagine we're going to see this bug class, you know, show up even more as people figure out how else to use it.
A bug hunter named Rob Dyke, and this is another one from Daily Swig. They've actually, you know, we got a few from them this week. A bug hunter named Rob Dyke in a bit of legal hot water after doing some pretty normal stuff by the looks of things.
Yeah, this guy found some code repositories and things on GitHub, I think it was, that had a bunch of secrets, internal data and stuff relating to a company that provides healthcare-related technology in the UK. He took a screenshot, reported it to them, and suggested that perhaps they didn't want that data on the public network. All went well, you know, with his exchange with them, until later he gets a, you know, message from their lawyers, and they've talked to the UK police, who now want to talk to him, and so on and so forth. And it's kind of turned into a pretty, you know, ugly fight in which, you know, what seems on the face of it to be good, responsible disclosure has turned into, you know, legal wrangling by an organization that's funded by the UK government. So, yeah, a bit nasty.
Yeah, it is a bit nasty, but I think typically what happens is these things get a lot of attention and then they tend to get resolved because it's not, you know, 2001 anymore. So let's, yeah, fingers crossed that all works out. Now, as regular listeners would know, I absolutely loathe Cloudflare as a company and everything it stands for. But, you know, there's no question that they do some pretty useful stuff here and there. And they've launched a like a script dependency monitor, like a JavaScript dependency monitor for websites. And it looks actually, as annoying as it is, it actually looks quite useful.
Yeah, this is actually really solid work. Cloudflare has got an option where they will introduce like a content security header into messages going out to the browser, which asks the browser to report in about what JavaScript they're running in the web page, which is the normal part of the content security policy process. And then they're using that to match against what they expect to be in the page and provide alerts to sites using this Cloudflare service when the JavaScript that their users are running changes, which is the perfect way to kind of go about catching Magecart style JavaScript injection where, you know, the script hosters have been compromised and then having that script modified to scrape payment details or whatever other thing the attacker wants to do. And yeah, this is a smart way to do it because a lot of people are, you know, would use Cloudflare already, have a bunch of security controls in there. This is an extra one that, you know, makes a lot of sense. You know, Cloudflare is in a very sensible place to do this sort of thing and to help developers and off-site operators spot this stuff fast enough to perhaps, you know, prevent the impact from being really bad.
Another one from Adam Bannister over at the Daily Swig. Microsoft Teams there's going to be a bug bounty for Microsoft Teams, which is something that I know, Adam, you've wanted to see for a while.
Yeah, we certainly threw a little bit of salt at Microsoft a while back when there was that report of code exec via the Teams thick client application, Electron-based thick client, which was previously, when the bug was reported, was out of scope for the bug bounty for Microsoft's cloud services. And Teams is a combination of, you know, a web interface and a bunch of services, but also there's a thick client app that was, in this case, out of scope. And the impact of the bug in the web browser was meh, and the impact of the bug in the thick client, which everybody uses, was remote code.
Yeah, but they said it wasn't. They said it wasn't like a thing because they blocked it server side, which was just dumb. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, Microsoft have now announced an applications bug bounty program, which at the moment only covers the Teams thick client, up to $30,000 for remote code execution. So definitely get hunting. There are inevitably going to be some good bugs in it, so I'm sure people will find those.
Yeah.
And it's good to see Microsoft, you know, I guess, either taking some feedback or they were intending to do the sensible thing in the first place and it just took them a while. But, you know, whatever it is, it's going to result in, you know, improved security robustness for Teams, which, let's face it, everybody needs when they've been migrating everything into the Microsoft cloud.
I mean, I would have thought 30K for an O-Day exploit chain in Teams, which is a messaging app, I mean, I would have thought it would be worth more. So this tells me they're not, you know, if they set it to 100K, they're worried they're going to blow their budget is how I read that, yeah, you know.
You're probably right. And yeah, 30K does seem kind of cheap for how good a Teams RCE would be.
Let's see, because they probably had some time to actually harden it up, you know, internally. So they're probably just ready for it now. And I don't think anyone was expecting Teams to become so critical so quickly. And I think COVID's been a big part of that.
Yeah, I think you're right there. Yeah. There's you know, filled a slice of the ecosystem that people weren't expecting, perhaps. And certainly Slack probably weren't expecting.
Yeah, that's true, actually. What else have we got here? Oh, speaking of, yeah, okay. I see what you did there. Because the next story is about Slack. They introduced a feature which would allow anyone to message anyone else on Slack without the ability to block and report and all of that sort of stuff, which was just a really dumb idea, and they reversed it pretty quick.
Yeah, which, I mean, you know, Slack doesn't get everything right, but at least they do listen to feedback and perhaps they'll think about what they've done when they're moving on. Because, yeah, you get the feeling that Slack is going to really kind of gear up and try and, you know, take on the Microsoft behemoth and do this stuff better and with a more kind of acceptable user interface, perhaps. And this is not a good example of that, so perhaps they'll learn.
Now, we just spoke about someone throwing in the text string Zerodium for the lols. We're going to talk about another text string here. This is our skateboarding dog of the week, and it comes to us via Brian Krebs at KrebsOnSecurity.com.
Yes, somebody has been going around owning Exchange servers. No surprise there. Dropping ransomware on Exchange servers. Also, no surprise. In this particular case, they've been dropping KrebsOnSecurity.exe, which communicates with command and control at
Brian.KrebsOnSecurity.top.
Which Brian, as it pains to point out, is not in fact operated by him. He is not owning your Exchange servers. Krebs gets a lot of stuff thrown at him. This is perhaps less fancy than the, you know, time he got heroin shipped to his door or swatted or whatever else other bad stuff happens to him. But Krebs must, maybe he's got like a, you know, a trophy wall in his office, you know, with all the pictures of things that people have blamed on him.
I'm sure he would. I mean, it's all part of the game for him, I think, you know, like at this point. if it really bothered him, he'd probably stop doing it, you know, but there you go. Rightio, Adam, that's actually it for the week's news. Now, of course, you know, I'm half surprised that we actually managed to squeeze out a show this week because, regular listeners would know, me and my partner were expecting the birth of our second child pretty much any day now. And in fact, next week, if the baby isn't born, they're going to induce. So there's no way I'm coming back next week. So I'm taking 3 weeks paternity leave. So it's going to be a little while before we chat again.
It will, and obviously best of luck to you and Mrs. Business on new baby times. That's always a wonderful experience, and I'm glad that you're going to have a bit of space to enjoy it. And, you know, as is traditional, whenever you're off the beat, a whole bunch of terrible things happen in the InfoSec world. So it's going to be an exciting few weeks for us and an exciting few weeks for you. And then when you get back, oh boy, we're going to have so much stuff to talk about.
Well, it's carnage all around, really, when you think about it. Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Nothing like a new baby to make things interesting, right? So yep, we'll all be suffering together. Let's think of it that way.
We will. We will indeed.
All right, mate. Well, I'll see you when I'm back from leave. Thanks a lot for today.
Good luck, and I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Big thanks to him for that. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with security legend HD Moore. HD is best known as the creator of Metasploit, and he is back with a new venture, and it's called Rumble. And look, this is a sponsor interview like any other sponsor interview, but I do need to disclose that I'm actually an advisor to Rumble, which means I'm doing a bit of work for them in exchange for a tiny little sliver of share options, and I just like to be transparent about things. So just had to mention that. Rumble is, as I mentioned, it's HD's new business, and I'm a huge fan, right? Because you could just call it an asset discovery tool, you know, for internal assets, but that is just selling it massively short, because once you see this thing in action, it will leave your jaw on the floor. Back in 2018, I was actually staying at HD's house for a few nights before heading over to Black Hat, because when you're flying to the US from Australia, you really need a few days to get over the jet lag. So yeah, normally I'll fly into the United States, I'll stay with a friend, get my sleep right, and then onwards from there. So in 2018, I was at his place, and he was already working on Rumble back then. And we were just having huge conversations about asset discovery stuff because at the time, I was a real fan of the passive approach to network discovery, and that's where you tap into span ports everywhere and you infer asset information from network traffic, and you can get pretty deep information that way. But the problem with passive asset discovery is that it's a real pain in the ass to deploy, and also that devices need to send traffic past those span ports in order for you to sort of infer what they are. Now, the advantage of active asset discovery is that it's basically it's deploying it is instant. But the disadvantage is, you know, coverage just usually isn't that good. But that's the problem HD has solved with Rumble. And straight up, seeing it in action, it's spooky. It can find stuff that it just shouldn't be able to find. It can give you a level of detail that it just shouldn't be able to give. You know, it can give you the serial numbers off your routers. It can find entire networks that you didn't know about that are in your environment. You know, it can even tell you, hey, here are three MAC addresses corresponding to one device. And by the way, one of those MAC addresses is an LTE interface. So it is straight up mad genius stuff that erases a lot of the previous barriers for active asset discovery. And I didn't know that it was possible to do this, right? So it's very, very cool stuff. So the end result is you can basically sit anywhere in a large network and just map it out. As I mentioned, it's zero effort deployment and gives you good coverage. And I can't really think of a reason that anyone wouldn't use this, to be honest. Now, before we even start the interview, I'll tell you that you can grab a free version from rumble.run and you can have a play with that. So yeah, rumble.run. And yeah, you really should go have a play with it, because seeing is believing. So here is HD Moore talking about Rumble, what it is, what it's for. Enjoy.
We launched this thing in beta back in March of 2019 and spent 6 months just trying to get a handle on like what it was useful for, how people wanted to use it, what type of kind of workflows made sense. And over the last year or so, it's really kind of become crystal clear like what the big ones are. Definitely SOC, incident response, policy enforcement, policy compliance, all that really plays a big part. If someone wants to go figure out what's on the network, get initial visibility into it, and then figure out how something is exposed or what other systems look like that, or to find machines that are unmanaged or orphaned, Rumble's been a great tool for that. So we definitely support the SOC use case, as well as things like orphan device detection, incident response, and of course, like policy enforcement.
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, the SOC use case, because I spend so much time talking to people who work in large companies and stuff, and they have the SOCs, the SOC use case, it just seems to me like it is something you would want to have. Can you give us like a more specific example of how a SOC might use Rumble and find it useful?
Yeah, sure thing. So when we first started out, we didn't think our UI would be good enough for anyone to actually use. We thought it'd be something that people would take data from Rumble and then push it into Splunk, they push it into some other, you know, SIM and do all the work from there. What was really surprising is we found out that a lot of folks actually liked our UI better. So we started seeing instant response folks and SOC folks using Rumble all day long to figure out, okay, when did this device join this network? What domain is this asset joined to? And some of the fun things we can do in our UI as opposed to exporting data are things like multi-home host detection. We can identify a machine that's on multiple networks at once, unauthenticated through all sorts of fun magic in the back end.
Yeah, so I should say too that when you demoed this to me a few weeks ago, there were a few moments during that demo where I was like, wait, hang on, stop. How did you do that, right? And you pretty much said, don't worry, your pretty little journalist head. You know, I never, but it is, there is this sort of magical thing about it. So, I mean, we should probably outline the capabilities of, you know, the core Rumble scanner, because it is, and I'm not kidding. It is one of those things that when you see it and you see the sorts of data it can get, you really do wonder how on earth you actually managed to pull it off. So, I mean, you could go like five hops deep, right, in a network.
Yeah, we do some really neat stuff. So we took like every cool pen testing security analysis research trick of the last 25 years and baked that into our discovery protocol. So we'll do things like identify the MAC addresses of Windows machines and remote networks that a firewall enables by getting their MAC addresses out of a neighboring printer's ARP cache. We'll do things like dumping the VLAN tables of a neighboring switch. We'll pull secondary IP addresses out of things like NetBIOS. We can take the persistent GUID identifier of Windows machine and track it as it moves around the network over SMB without authentication, things like that. So we just go really, really deep in the protocol side and find any information link we can that tells us more about the information's the device's IP address, host names, configuration, OS version, MAC addresses, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, you've even got MSSPs using this to do like Cisco management, like Cisco serial, to find all the Cisco serials and do Cisco management, right? Like you're pulling serial devices. I remember there was one point in your demo where you're like, okay, so this MAC address and this MAC address, they're on the same box. It's this type of device. And that MAC address, by the way, is an LTE NIC that's not even on the network. And I'm just like, how?
Yeah, it's a lot of fun work. So for MSPs, we try to support all sorts of stuff, everything from identifying devices that have been depreciated, things that need to be replaced. We help them get budget to replace old hardware, things like that. We help them pull warranty information by pulling service tags out of Dell iDRAX, by pulling serial numbers out of Cisco devices. So we do a lot of stuff that's outside of your normal realm of basic security work. It's more of like your IT and finance support and networking operations support in those cases.
Now, I understand recently you had a customer who was using ServiceNow. And they said, oh, you know, we've got 27 routers, according to ServiceNow. You went in there and you found over 1,000. Is that right?
It is. Like, the challenge we run into is that ServiceNow and a lot of authenticated discovery tools are really great when they're configured perfectly, when they've got exact visibility, exact credentials, everything on your network. What they're really not great at is telling you about the things that they can't authenticate to. And they're really not good at highlighting all those unknowns that they find. So what we do is we run network discovery and asset inventory unauthenticated by default. So we tell you about everything we see, no matter what it is, whether you can log into it or not. And there's always a huge difference between what we find and what authenticated discovery tools find, because we look at everything across the board where they're really looking at things that they can authenticate to, and that's it.
You even had one customer who found a network they didn't know about.
Absolutely. Yeah. So there's a lot of fun ways that we can identify multi-homed assets. This is the trick that we actually sort of pioneered in Metasploit, actually. It was a way to, through the NetBIOS UDP protocol, you first ask a machine for its name, you get back its MAC address, some other fun stuff. But if you do a second request, say, hey, Mr. Machine, what IP addresses do you have? It'll come back and give you a list of all the IPv4 interfaces hanging off that device as well. So we actually have that baked into the Rumble scanner. It's one of the things we do to identify secondary networks hanging off different devices. So we can tell you whether your CDE is accidentally being bridged to your wireless network, whether your wireless network's being bridged to your wired network. And in one case, we had an admin who ran a scan and identified a subnet he didn't realize was even there. And it was a previous system administrator hosting illegal content off of his network.
Yeah, that's probably not what you want. So someone got fired. Well done, HD, getting someone fired. Nice work.
Oh, we provide visibility, right?
Yeah, we don't make the decisions. Now, look, I'm sure some people listening are like, well, you know, this scanning activity, right? It's got to generate a lot of noise. Do you run into problems with sort of IDSs and stuff flagging traffic from Rumble and throwing up alerts into the SOC?
We run into the weirdest network configurations you can possibly imagine. I mean, if you look at, we have customers who scan through FortiGate firewalls, through VPN adapters, through devices that basically do, you know, monkey in the middle of all your traffic. And a lot of what we do on the Rumble side is making all that noise go away, is we magically detect all the stuff that is bogus, all the fake responses, all the H323 SIP helpers, all the bogus proxy responses, and they just magically disappear from your scan results. So we spent a lot of effort trying to make it that you can scan anywhere from anywhere and still have credible results when you're done with. And
I get that. I just wondered if it's noisy and it actually throws people alerts. Like, you know, does Rumble look like an attacker when you're running a scan? And you know, is it going to set off your IDS?
Oh, that's a good point. No, we don't actually send any traffic that is intentionally security relative. So we don't send a single packet that was designed to identify a vulnerability or to enumerate a version outside of normal traffic. So a lot of what we're doing is very similar to passive traffic analysis, except we're generating your own traffic and observing the responses coming back in. So it's not that it's like a crafty, you know, vulnerability scan where it's sending all these kind of malformed things trying to get responses. We have a custom scan engine written from scratch to send the safest possible traffic that's as load balanced as widely as thinly as possible across the network. And then basically we observe the responses and pull all of our magic data out of the response that we see in the wire.
So the obvious question is, can you use this as a offsec tool, right? Because I'd imagine as a red teamer, this would be pretty handy, you know? And I also think it's a bit of a sad indictment on the state of things that you can actually get this much visibility into a network without setting off any alarm bells. But have you used this, you know, on red team engagements? Because I remember you were working for Artritis when you were building this product. So did you ever use it on those sort of engagements?
Oh, absolutely. Use it on almost every single gig. It's really, really good for finding segmentation violations in CDEs for like merchant banks and large financials. One of the things that's really fun about it is you can take our command line scanner, which runs offline. You can pop a Windows box, a Citrix server, copy the binary to that machine and start running scans from that Citrix box and start getting a great pivot discovery of that. We also compromise things like PoE cameras and NAS devices, install the binaries, install the scanners and those, ran scans from those systems instead. So we make it really easy to do to pivot your discovery task when a new machine you happen to get a foothold on. Granted, that's not our normal, you know, sales case for the product, but it's definitely very effective for that as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just there's a lot of pen testers and red teamers who listen to the show, and I'm sure they were thinking it, right? And I'm just sort of surprised, like, do you hear of red teamers and pen testers using it?
We do, but I'm actually surprised less people use it than they do. As a red team, I use it every single time I had a gig. It was great. It like found me so much stuff that you wouldn't find otherwise. Like I can find a way into the network that I couldn't find any other pivot point into just by running a quick scan. But I think because it's very focused on like IT discovery, because it's mostly kind of a cloud first product, because the command line's a little bit clunky, it's definitely not our target market. But if you know how to use it, it's amazing for that work.
It's funny, right? Before when you were saying, oh, it's we didn't expect them to like our interface. I think you have overestimated the quality of the interfaces the typical SOC has to use in the day-to-day of their work. Let's just talk about another couple of essential use cases, right? Like something like, there were those embedded device bugs. I can't remember this. Someone gave them a fancy name, but they were, you know, bugs that would affect things like IP phones and whatnot. You know, Rumble's very good in those sort of instances for being able to find that stuff in your network, because stuff like that, it's not typically managed, right? So, yeah, being able to find that is very, very useful. Have you had customers using it for things like that?
Absolutely. One of the most common requests we get is, you know, a new vulnerability comes out. And even though we don't really do vulnerability scanning, we already have most of the data already there in the data set. So, for example, with the Ripple 20 vulnerabilities.
That's the ones I was thinking of. Yeah, the Ripple 20.
Yeah, that's a case where you can identify them by looking at the difference of the TTL response between ICMP ping and a TCP reset. So if you have scan traffic already in the data set and stored from an ICMP response and from a TCP response, and you can tell that one of their TTLs is 128 and one's 255, you know it's a Trek OS device. So that's one way that we quickly were able to filter out which devices were potentially Trek OS, which ones are possibly vulnerable to Ripple to the Ripple 20 vulnerabilities from data that was already there. We do the same thing for like SolarWinds, for the zero logon bug, for the proxy logon stuff in Exchange. Every time a new big vulnerability comes out, our customers already have that data in the platform. They just have to know how to search for it.
Yeah.
So we help them basically create search queries against their data set and quickly find all those Orion boxes or quickly find all their Exchange servers.
And again, you know, we should point out that this is a network-based discovery tool. It's for use internally. It's not an external asset discovery tool. There are other products for that. This is very much about finding stuff that you are, yeah, on-prem, right?
Yeah, we have customers that use it for external cloud scanning as well, internal VPC clouding, scanning, SD-WAN, hyperscale, anything that has an IP address you can really scan with Rumble. But, you know, kind of our meat and potatoes is supporting internal network discovery for large, complicated, you know, just chaotic internal environments.
Well, and when you say cloud too, you're meaning sort of AWS self-managed environments and stuff, not O365 or, you know, like hosted Confluence or whatever the hell. All right. So look, I just want to go back briefly and touch on the ServiceNow stuff, because that's actually turned out to be a pretty solid growing customer base for you, as a lot of organizations using ServiceNow are buying Rumble. Why is that?
A lot of organizations really need something to get a handle on their asset inventory, and ServiceNow has sold them that their CNDB product and, you know, all of their ITSM and ITOM stuff has been the way to do that. The challenge, though, is that getting data into ServiceNow for your network-connected assets has been really difficult if you don't have credentials to talk to them, and especially difficult if they're an unmanaged device in the first place, something like a vendor NAS device or a smart TV or an Amazon Echo or things like that. There's just not really a good way to bring that data into products like ServiceNow. So a lot of what we focus on in Rumble with our ServiceNow integration is trying to map those things, do the CI class mappings, do all the kind of the heavy grunt work of trying to figure out how is this device connected to that other device? Is it going through the switch? Is it going through this port? What interface does it hang off of? And so it's not the most pleasant work in the world to do all that mapping, but it's really important to getting the right relationships in place when you are using ServiceNow as your CMDB.
Because some people, I believe, they're baking off ServiceNow versus just using Rumble, but for a lot of them, they're going for both, right?
Yeah, end of the day, I mean, they're still going to want to use ServiceNow for their IT asset inventory, but they do need a better way of getting scan data into it. And, you know, ServiceNow has a discovery product, their mid-server for doing active scanning, and it's, you know, works pretty well when you have credentials for it. But the challenge is a lot of organizations have things that you just don't want to log into. Like, you're not going to send your password to your printer, for example. Like, there's a lot of devices where you don't want to sling your password around the network you discover in the first place.
Well, HD Moore, that is all really interesting stuff. You and I have been talking about Rumble for literally years, so it's, you know, it's just really great to have this conversation publicly. And yeah, thanks for joining us in this week's sponsor interview. It was great to see you.
Absolutely. Thanks, Pat.
That was HD Moore there, and you can check out Rumble, as I mentioned, at rumble.run, and yeah, do it. And that is it for this week's show, and that is it for Risky Business for a few weeks. So good luck, everyone. I'll probably drop a Snake Oilers podcast that I've already recorded in the next couple of weeks. I'm not exactly sure when yet, but that will be happening. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.